This is disc number 8.
Toward the end, she started taking an interest in various crackpot theories, astrology, psychic phenomena, vague spiritualist notions about the soul, until it became impossible to talk to her without being worn down to silence as she lectured on the corruption of the human body. Relations between Fanshawe and his mother became tense. She clung to him for support, acting as though the family's pain belonged only to her. Fanshawe had to be the solid one in the house. Not only did he have to take care of himself, he had to assume responsibility for his sister, who was just 12 at the time. But this brought with it another set of problems. For Ellen was a troubled, unstable child. And in the parental void that ensued from the illness, she began to look to Fanshawe for everything. He became her father, her mother, her bastion of wisdom and comfort. Fanshawe understood how unhealthy her dependence on him was, but there was little he could do about it, short of hurting her in some irreparable way. I remember how my own mother would talk about poor Jane, Mrs. Fanshawe, and how terrible the whole thing was for the baby. But I knew that in some sense it was Fanshawe who suffered the most. It was just that he never got a chance to show it. As for Fanshawe's father, there is little I can say with any certainty. He was a cipher to me, a silent man of abstracted benevolence, and I never got to know him well. Whereas my father tended to be around a lot, especially on the weekends, Fanshawe's father was rarely to be seen. He was a lawyer of some prominence, and at one time he had had political ambitions, but these had ended in a series of disappointments. He usually worked until late, pulling into the driveway at 8 or 9 o'clock, and often spent Saturday and part of Sunday at his office. I doubt that he ever knew quite what to make of his son, for he seemed to be a man with little feeling for children, someone who had lost all memory of having been a child himself. Mr. Fanshawe was so thoroughly adult, so completely immersed in serious grown-up matters, that I imagine it was hard for him not to think of us as creatures from another world. He was not yet 50 when he died. For the last 6 months of his life, after the doctors had given up hope of saving him, he lay in the spare bedroom of the Fanshawe house, watching the yard through the window, reading an occasional book, taking his painkillers, dozing. Fanshawe spent most of his free time with him then, and though I can only speculate on what happened, I assume that things changed between them. At the very least, I know how hard he worked at it, often staying home from school to be with him, trying to make himself indispensable, nursing him with unflinching attentiveness. It was a grim thing for Fanshawe to go through, too much for him, perhaps, and though he seemed to take it well, summoning up the bravery that is possible only in the very young, I sometimes wonder if he ever managed to get over it. There is only one more thing I want to mention here. At the end of this period, the very end, when no one expected Fanshawe's father to last more than a few days, Fanshawe and I went for a drive after school. It was February, and a few minutes after we started, a light snow began to fall. We drove aimlessly, looping through some of the neighboring towns, paying little attention to where we were. 10 or 15 miles from home, we came upon a cemetery. The gate happened to be open, and for no particular reason, we decided to drive in. After a while, we stopped the car and began to wander around on foot. We read the inscriptions on the stones, speculated on what each of those lives might have been, fell silent. Walked some more, talked, fell silent again. By now the snow was coming down heavily, and the ground was turning white. Somewhere in the middle of the cemetery there was a freshly dug grave, and Fanshawe and I stopped at the edge and looked down into it. I can remember how quiet it was, how far away the world seemed to be from us. For a long time neither one of us spoke. And then Fanshawe said that he wanted to see what it was like at the bottom. I gave him my hand and held on tightly as he lowered himself into the grave. When his feet touched the ground, he looked back up at me with a half smile, and then lay down on his back as though pretending to be dead. It is still completely vivid to me. Looking down at Fanshawe as he looked up at the sky, his eyes blinking furiously as the snow fell onto his face. By some obscure train of thought, it made me think back to when we were very small, no more than 4 or 5 years old. Fanshawe's parents had bought some new appliance, a television perhaps, and for several months Fanshawe kept the cardboard box in his room. He had always been generous in sharing his toys, but this box was off limits to me, and he never let me go in it. It was his secret place, he told me, and when he sat inside and closed it up around him, he could go wherever he wanted to go, could be wherever he wanted to be. But if another person ever entered his box, then its magic would be lost for good. I believed this story and did not press him for a turn, although it nearly broke my heart. We would be playing in his room, quietly setting up soldiers or drawing pictures, and then, out of the blue, Fanshawe would announce that he was going into his box. I would try to go on with what I had been doing, but it was never any use. Nothing interested me so much as what was happening to Fanshawe inside the box, and I would spend those minutes desperately trying to imagine the adventures he was having. But I never learned what they were, since it was also against the rules for Fanshawe to talk about them after he climbed out. Something similar was happening now in that open grave in the snow. Fanshawe was alone down there, thinking his thoughts, living through those moments by himself. And though I was present, the event was sealed off from me, as though I was not really there at all. I understood that this was Fanshawe's way of imagining his father's death. Again, it was a matter of pure chance. The open grave was there, and Fanshawe had felt it calling out to him. Stories happen only to those who are able to tell them, someone once said. In the same way, perhaps, experiences present themselves only to those who are able to have them. But this is a difficult point, and I can't be sure of any of it. I stood there waiting for Fanshawe to come up, trying to imagine what he was thinking, for a brief moment trying to see what he was seeing. Then I turned my head up to the darkening winter sky, and everything was a chaos of snow rushing down on top of me. By the time we started walking back to the car, the sun had set. We stumbled our way through the cemetery, not saying anything to each other. Several inches of snow had fallen, and it kept coming down more and more heavily as though it would never stop. We reached the car, climbed in, and then, against all our expectations, couldn't get moving. The back tires were stuck in a shallow ditch, and nothing we did made any difference. We pushed, we jostled, and still the tires spun with that horrible, futile noise. Half an hour went by, and then we gave up, reluctantly deciding to abandon the car. We hitchhiked home in the storm, and another 2 hours went by before we finally made it back. It was only then that we learned that Fanshawe's father had died during the afternoon. Chapter 3. Several days went by before I found the courage to open the suitcases. I finished the article I was working on, I went to the movies, I accepted invitations I normally would have turned down. These tactics did not fool me, however. Too much depended on my response, and the possibility of being disappointed was something I did not want to face. There was no difference in my mind between giving the order to destroy Fanshawe's work and killing him with my own hands. I had been given the power to obliterate, to steal a body from its grave and tear it to pieces. It was an intolerable position to be in, and I wanted no part of it. As long as I left the suitcases untouched, my conscience would be spared. On the other hand, I had made a promise, and I knew that I could not delay forever. It was just at this point, gearing myself up, getting ready to do it, that a new dread took hold of me. If I did not want Fanshawe's work to be bad, I discovered, I also did not want it to be good. This is a difficult feeling for me to explain. Old rivalries no doubt had something to do with it, a desire not to be humbled by Fanshawe's brilliance. But there was also a feeling of being trapped. I had given my word. Once I opened the suitcases, I would become Fanshawe's spokesman, and I would go on speaking for him, whether I liked it or not. Both possibilities frightened me. To issue a death sentence was bad enough, but working for a dead man hardly seemed better. For several days, I moved back and forth between these fears, unable to decide which one was worse. In the end, of course, I did open the suitcases, but by then it probably had less to do with Fanshawe than it did with Sophie. I wanted to see her again, and the sooner I got to work, the sooner I would have a reason to call her. I am not planning to go into any details here. By now, everyone knows what Fanshawe's work is like. It has been read and discussed. There have been articles and studies. It has become public property. If there is anything to be said, it is only that it took me no more than an hour or two to understand that my feelings were quite beside the point. To care about words, to have a stake in what is written, to believe in the power of books, this overwhelms the rest, and beside it, one's life becomes very small. I did not say this in order to congratulate myself or to put my actions in a better light. I was the first, but beyond that, I see nothing to set me apart from anyone else. If Fanshawe's work had been any less than it was, my role would have been different, more important, perhaps, more crucial to the outcome of the story. But as it was, I was no more than an invisible instrument. Something had happened, and short of denying it, short of pretending I had not opened the suitcases, it would go on happening, knocking down whatever was in front of it, moving with a momentum of its own. It took me about a week to digest and organize the material, to divide finished work from drafts, to gather the manuscripts into some semblance of chronological order. The earliest piece was a poem, dating from 1963, when Fanshawe was 16, and the last was from 1976, just 1 month before he disappeared. In all, there were over 100 poems, 3 novels, 2 short and 1 long, and 5 one-act plays, as well as 13 notebooks, which contained a number of aborted pieces, sketches, jottings, remarks on the books Fanshawe was reading, and ideas for future projects. There were no letters, no diaries, no glimpses into Fanshawe's private life. But that was something I had expected. A man does not spend his time hiding from the world without making sure to cover his tracks. Still, I had thought that somewhere among all the papers there might be some mention of me. If only a letter of instruction or a notebook entry naming me his literary executor. But there was nothing. Fanshawe had left me entirely on my own. I telephoned Sophie and arranged to have dinner with her the following night. Because I suggested a fashionable French restaurant, way beyond what I could afford, I think she was able to guess my response to Fanshawe's work. But beyond this hint of a celebration, I said as little as I could. I wanted everything to advance at its own pace. No abrupt moves, no premature gestures. I was already certain about Fanshawe's work, but I was afraid to rush into things with Sophie. Too much hinged on how I acted, too much could be destroyed by blundering at the start. Sophie and I were linked now, whether she knew it or not, if only to the extent that we would be partners in promoting Fanshawe's work. But I wanted more than that, and I wanted Sophie to want it as well. Struggling against my eagerness, I urged caution on myself, told myself to think ahead. She wore a black silk dress, tiny silver earrings, and had swept back her hair to show the line of her neck. As she walked into the restaurant and saw me sitting at the bar, she gave me a warm, complicitous smile, as though telling me she knew how beautiful she was, but at the same time commenting on the weirdness of the occasion, savoring it somehow, clearly alert to the outlandish implications of the moment. I told her that she was stunning, and she answered almost whimsically that this was her first night out since Ben had been born, and that she had wanted to look different. After that, I stuck to business, trying to hang back within myself. When we were led to our table and given our seats, white tablecloth, heavy silverware, a red tulip, and a slender vase between us, I responded to her second smile by talking about Fanshawe. She did not seem surprised by anything I said. It was old news for her, a fact that she had already come to terms with, and what I was telling her merely confirmed what she had known all along. Strangely enough, it did not seem to excite her. There was a wariness in her attitude that confused me, and for several minutes I was lost. Then, slowly, I began to understand that her feelings were not very different from my own. Fanshawe had disappeared from her life, and I saw that she might have good reason to resent the burden that had been imposed on her. By publishing Fanshawe's work, by devoting herself to a man who was no longer there, she would be forced to live in the past, and whatever future she might want to build for herself would be tainted by the role she had to play, the official widow, the dead writer's muse, the beautiful heroine in a tragic story. No one wants to be part of a fiction, and even less so if that fiction is real. Sophie was just 26 years old. She was too young to live through someone else, too intelligent not to want a life that was completely her own. The fact that she had loved Fanshawe was not the point. Fanshawe was dead, and it was time for her to leave him behind. None of this was said in so many words, but the feeling was there, and it would have been senseless to ignore it. Given my own reservations, it was odd that I should have been the one to carry the torch, but I saw that if I didn't take hold of the thing and get it started, the job would never get done. "You don't really have to get involved," I said. "We'll have to consult, of course, but that shouldn't take up too much of your time. If you're willing to leave the decisions to me, I don't think it will be very bad at all." "Of course I'll leave them to you," she said. "I don't know the first thing about any of this. If I tried to do it myself, I'd get lost within 5 minutes." "The important thing is to know that we're on the same side," I said. "In the end, I suppose it boils down to whether or not you can trust me."
"I trust you," she said.
"I haven't given you any reason to," I said. "Not yet, in any case."
"I know that, but I trust you anyway."
"Just like that?"
"Yes, just like that."
She smiled at me again, and for the rest of the dinner we said nothing more about Fanshawe's work. I had been planning to discuss it in detail, how best to begin, what publishers might be interested, what people to contact, and so on, but this no longer seemed important. Sophie was quite content not to think about it, and now that I had reassured her that she didn't have to, her playfulness gradually returned. After so many difficult months, she finally had a chance to forget some of it for a while, and I could see how determined she was to lose herself in the very simple pleasures of this moment, the restaurant, the food, the laughter of the people around us, the fact that she was here and not anywhere else. She wanted to be indulged in all this, and who was I not to go along with her? I was in good form that night. Sophie inspired me. And it didn't take long for me to get warmed up. I cracked jokes, told stories, performed little tricks with the silverware. The woman was so beautiful that I had trouble keeping my eyes off her. I wanted to see her laugh, to see how her face would respond to what I said, to watch her eyes, to study her gestures. God knows what absurdities I came out with, but I did my best to detach myself, to bury my real motives under this onslaught of charm. That was the hard part. I knew that Sophie was lonely, that she wanted the comfort of a warm body beside her, But a quick roll in the hay was not what I was after, and if I moved too fast, that was probably all it would turn out to be. At this early stage, Fanshawe was still there with us, the unspoken link, the invisible force that had brought us together. It would take some time before he disappeared, and until that happened, I found myself willing to wait. All this created an exquisite tension. As the evening progressed, the most casual remarks became tinged with erotic overtones. Words were no longer simply words, but a curious code of silences, a way of speaking that continually moved around the thing that was being said. As long as we avoided the real subject, the spell would not be broken. We both slipped naturally into this kind of banter, and it became all the more powerful because neither one of us abandoned the charade. We knew what we were doing, but at the same time, we pretended not to. Thus, my courtship of Sophie began, slowly, decorously, building by the smallest of increments. After dinner, we walked for 20 minutes or so in the late November darkness, then finished up the evening with drinks in a bar downtown. I smoked one cigarette after another, but that was the only clue to my tumult. Sophie talked for a while about her family in Minnesota, her three younger sisters, her arrival in New York 8 years ago, her music, her teaching, her plan to go back to it next fall. But we were so firmly entrenched in our jocular mode by then that each remark became an excuse for additional laughter. It would have gone on, but there was the babysitter to think about, and so we finally cut it short at around midnight. I took her to the door of her apartment and made my last great effort of the evening.
"Thank you, doctor," Sophie said. "The operation was a success."
"My patients always survive," I said. "It's the laughing gas. I just turn on the valve and little by little they get better."
"That gas might be habit forming."
"That's the point. The patients keep coming back for more, sometimes two or three operations a week. How do you think I paid for my Park Avenue apartment and the summer place in France?"
"So there's a hidden motive."
"Absolutely. I'm driven by greed."
"Your practice must be booming."
"It was, but I'm more or less retired now. I'm down to one patient these days, and I'm not sure if she'll be coming back."
"She'll be back," Sophie said, with the coyest, most radiant smile I had ever seen. "You can count on it."
"That's good to hear," I said. "I'll have my secretary call her to schedule the next appointment."
"The sooner the better. With these long-term treatments, you can't waste a moment."
"Excellent advice. I'll remember to order a new supply of laughing gas."
"You do that, doctor. I really think I need it."
We smiled at each other again, and then I wrapped her up in a big bear hug, gave her a brief kiss on the lips, and got down the stairs as fast as I could. I went straight home, realized that bed was out of the question, and then spent 2 hours in front of the television, watching a movie about Marco Polo. I finally conked out at around 4, in the middle of a Twilight Zone rerun. My first move was to contact Stuart Green, an editor at one of the larger publishing houses. I didn't know him very well, but we had grown up in the same town, and his younger brother, Roger, had gone through school with me and Fanshawe. I guessed that Stuart would remember who Fanshawe was, and that seemed like a good way to get started. I had run into Stuart at various gatherings over the years, perhaps 3 or 4 times, and he had always been friendly, talking about the good old days, as he called them, and always promising to send my greetings to Roger the next time he saw him. I had no idea what to expect from Stuart, but he sounded happy enough to hear from me when I called. We arranged to meet at his office one afternoon that week. It took him a few moments to place Fanshawe's name. It was familiar to him, he said, but he didn't know from where. I prodded his memory a bit, mentioned Roger and his friends, and then it suddenly came back to him.
"Yes, yes, of course," he said. "Fanshawe. That extraordinary little boy. Roger used to insist that he would grow up to be president."
"That's the one," I said,
and then I told him the story. Stuart was a rather prissy fellow, a Harvard type who wore bow ties and tweed jackets, and though at bottom he was little more than a company man, in the publishing world he was what passed for an intellectual. He had done well for himself so far, a senior editor in his early 30s, a solid and responsible young worker, and there was no question that he was on the rise. I say all this only to prove that he was not someone who would be automatically susceptible to the kind of story I was telling. There was very little romance in him, very little that was not cautious and businesslike. But I could feel that he was interested, and as I went on talking, he even seemed to become excited. He had nothing to lose, of course. If Fanshawe's work didn't appeal to him, it would be simple enough for him to turn it down. Rejections were the heart of his job, and he wouldn't have to think twice about it. On the other hand, if Fanshawe was the writer I said he was, then publishing him could only help Stuart's reputation. He would share in the glory of having discovered an unknown American genius, and he would be able to live off this coup for years. I handed him the manuscript of Fanshawe's big novel. In the end, I said, it would have to be all or nothing. The poems, the plays, the other two novels. But this was Fanshawe's major work, and it was logical that it should come first. I was referring to Neverland, of course. Stuart said that he liked the title, but when he asked me to describe the book, I said that I'd rather not, that I thought it would be better if he found out for himself. He raised an eyebrow in response, a trick he had probably learned during his year at Oxford, as if to imply that I shouldn't play games with him. I wasn't, as far as I could tell. It was just that I didn't want to coerce him. The book could do the work itself, and I saw no reason to deny him the pleasure of entering it cold, with no map, no compass, no one to lead him by the hand. It took 3 weeks for him to get back to me. The news was neither good nor bad, but it seemed hopeful. There was probably enough support among the editors to get the book through, Stuart said, but before they made the final decision, they wanted to have a look at the other material. I had been expecting that, a certain prudence, playing it close to the vest, and told Stuart that I would come around to drop off the manuscripts the following afternoon. "It's a strange book," he said, pointing to the copy of Neverland on his desk. "Not at all your typical novel, you know? Not your typical anything. It's still not clear that we're going ahead with it, but if we do, publishing it will be something of a risk." "I know that," I said, "but that's what makes it interesting. The real pity is that Fanshawe isn't around. I'd love to be able to work with him. There are things in the book that should be changed, I think, certain passages that should be cut. It would make the book even stronger." "That's just editor's pride," I said. "It's hard for you to see a manuscript and not want to attack it with a red pencil. The fact is, I think the parts you object to now will eventually make sense to you, and you'll be glad you weren't able to touch them." "Time will tell," said Stuart, not ready to concede the point. "But there's no question," he went on, "no question that the man could write. I read the book more than 2 weeks ago, and it's been with me ever since. I can't get it out of my head. It keeps coming back to me, and always at the strangest moments. Stepping out of the shower, walking down the street, crawling into bed at night, whenever I'm not consciously thinking about anything. That doesn't happen very often, you know. You read so many books in this job that they all tend to blur together. But Fanshawe's book stands out. There's something powerful about it. And the oddest thing is that I don't even know what it is." "That's probably the real test," I said. "The same thing happened to me. The book gets stuck somewhere in the brain and you can't get rid of it."
"And what about the other stuff?"
"Same thing," I said. "You can't stop thinking about it." Stuart shook his head, and for the first time I saw that he was honestly impressed. It lasted no more than a moment, but in that moment his arrogance and posturing suddenly disappeared, and I almost found myself wanting to like him. "I think we might be onto something," he said.
If what you say is true, then I really think we might be onto something.
We were. And as things turned out, perhaps even more than Stuart had imagined. Neverland was accepted later that month, with an option on the other books as well. My quarter of the advance was enough to buy me some time, and I used it to work on an edition of the poems. I also went to a number of directors to see if there was any interest in doing the plays. Eventually, this came off, too, and a production of 3 one-acts was planned for a small downtown theater to open about 6 weeks after Neverland was published. In the meantime, I persuaded the editor of one of the bigger magazines I occasionally wrote for to let me do an article on Fanshawe. It turned out to be a long, rather exotic piece, and at the time I felt it was one of the best things I had ever written. The article was scheduled to appear 2 months before the publication of Neverland, and suddenly it seemed as though everything was happening at once. I admit that I got caught up in it all. One thing kept leading to another, and before I knew it, a small industry had been set in motion. It was a kind of delirium, I think. I felt like an engineer, pushing buttons and pulling levers, scrambling from valve chambers to circuit boxes, adjusting a part here, devising an improvement there, listening to the contraption hum and chug and purr, oblivious to everything but the din of my brainchild. I was the mad scientist who had invented the great hocus-pocus machine, and the more smoke that poured from it, the more noise it produced, the happier I was. Perhaps that was inevitable. Perhaps I needed to be a little mad in order to get started. Given the strain of reconciling myself to the project, it was probably necessary for me to equate Fanshawe's success with my own. I had stumbled onto a cause, a thing that justified me and made me feel important. And the more fully I disappeared into my ambitions for Fanshawe, the more sharply I came into focus for myself. This is not an excuse. It is merely a description of what happened. Hindsight tells me that I was looking for trouble, but at the time I knew nothing about it. More important, even if I had known, I doubt that it would have made a difference. Underneath it all was the desire to stay in touch with Sophie. As time went on, it became perfectly natural for me to call her 3 or 4 times a week, to see her for lunch, to stop by for an afternoon stroll through the neighborhood with Ben. I introduced her to Stuart Green, invited her along to meet the theater director, found her a lawyer to handle contracts and other legal matters. Sophie took all this in her stride, treating these encounters more as social occasions than as business talks, making it clear to the people we saw that I was the one in charge. I sensed that she was determined not to feel indebted to Fanshawe, that whatever happened or did not happen, she would continue to keep her distance from it. The money made her happy, of course, but she never really connected it to Fanshawe's work. It was an unlikely gift, a winning lottery ticket that had dropped from the sky, and that was all. Sophie saw through the whirlwind from the very start. She understood the fundamental absurdity of the situation, and because there was no greed in her, no impulse to press her own advantage, she did not lose her head. I worked hard at courting her. No doubt my motives were transparent, but perhaps that was to the good. Sophie knew that I had fallen in love with her, and the fact that I did not pounce on her, that I did not force her to declare her feelings for me, probably did more to convince her of my seriousness than anything else. Still, I could not wait forever. Discretion has its role, but too much of it can be fatal. A moment came when I could feel that we were no longer jousting with each other, that things between us had already been settled. In thinking about this moment now, I am tempted to use the traditional language of love. I want to talk in metaphors of heat, of burning, of barriers melting down in the face of irresistible passions. I am aware of how overblown these terms might sound. But in the end, I believe they are accurate. Everything had changed for me.
and words that I had never understood before suddenly began to make sense. This came as a revelation, and when I finally had time to absorb it, I wondered how I had managed to live so long without learning this simple thing. I'm not talking about desire so much as knowledge. The discovery that two people, through desire, can create a thing more powerful than either of them can create alone. This knowledge changed me, I think, and actually made me feel more human. By belonging to Sophie, I began to feel as though I belonged to everyone else as well. My true place in the world, it turned out, was somewhere beyond myself, and if that place was inside me, it was also unlocatable. This was the tiny hole between self and not self, and for the first time in my life, I saw this nowhere as the exact center of the world. It happened to be my 30th birthday. I had known Sophie for about 3 months by then, and she insisted on making an evening of it. I was reluctant at first, never having paid much attention to birthdays, but Sophie's sense of occasion finally won me over. She bought me an expensive illustrated edition of Moby Dick, took me to dinner in a good restaurant, and then ushered me along to a performance of Boris Godunov at the Met. For once, I let myself go with it, not trying to second-guess my happiness, not trying to stay ahead of myself or outmaneuver my feelings. Perhaps I was beginning to sense a new boldness in Sophie. Perhaps she was making it known to me that she had decided things for herself, that it was too late now for either one of us to back off. Whatever it was, that was the night when everything changed. When there was no longer any question of what we were going to do. We returned to her apartment at 11:30. Sophie paid the drowsy babysitter, and then we tiptoed into Ben's room and stood there for a while, watching him as he slept in his crib. I remember distinctly that neither one of us said anything, that the only sound I could hear was the faint gurgling of Ben's breath. We leaned over the bars and studied the shape of his little body, lying on his stomach, legs tucked under him, ass in the air, two or three fingers stuck in his mouth. It seemed to go on for a long time, but I doubt it was more than a minute or two. Then, without any warning, we both straightened up, turned towards each other, and began to kiss. After that, it is difficult for me to speak of what happened. Such things have little to do with words, so little, in fact, that it seems almost pointless to try to express them. If anything, I would say that we were falling into each other, that we were falling so fast and so far that nothing could catch us. Again, I lapse into metaphor, but that is probably beside the point. For whether or not I can talk about it does not change the truth of what happened. The fact is, there never was such a kiss, and in all my life I doubt there can ever be such a kiss again. Chapter 4. I spent that night in Sophie's bed, and from then on it became impossible to leave it. I would go back to my own apartment during the day to work, but every evening I would return to Sophie. I became a part of the household, shopping for dinner, changing Ben's diapers, taking out the garbage, living more intimately with another person than I had ever lived before. Months went by, and to my constant bewilderment, I discovered that I had a talent for this kind of life. I had been born to be with Sophie. And little by little, I could feel myself becoming stronger, could feel her making me better than I had been. It was strange how Fanshawe had brought us together. If not for his disappearance, none of this would have happened. I owed him a debt, but other than doing what I could for his work, I had no chance to pay it back. My article was published, and it seemed to have the desired effect. Stuart Green called to say that it was a great boost, which I gathered to mean that he felt more secure now in having accepted the book.
With all the interest the article had generated, Fanshawe no longer seemed like such a long shot. Then Neverland came out, and the reviews were uniformly good, some of them extraordinary. It was all that one could have hoped for. This was the fairy tale that every writer dreams about, and I admit that even I was a little shocked. Such things are not supposed to happen in the real world. Only a few weeks after publication, sales were greater than had been expected for the whole edition. A second printing eventually went to press. There were ads placed in newspapers and magazines, and then the book was sold to a paperback company for republication the following year. I don't mean to imply that the book was a bestseller by commercial standards or that Sophie was on her way to becoming a millionaire, but given the seriousness and difficulty of Fanshawe's work, and given the public's tendency to stay away from such work, it was a success beyond anything we had imagined possible. In some sense, this is where the story should end. The young genius is dead, but his work will live on. His name will be remembered for years to come. His childhood friend has rescued the beautiful young widow, and the two of them will live happily ever after. That would seem to wrap it up, with nothing left but a final curtain call. But it turns out that this is only the beginning. What I have written so far is no more than a prelude, a quick synopsis of everything that comes before the story I have to tell. If there were no more to it than this, there would be nothing at all, for nothing would have compelled me to begin. Only darkness has the power to make a man open his heart to the world. And darkness is what surrounds me whenever I think of what happened. If courage is needed to write about it, I also know that writing about it is the one chance I have to escape. But I doubt this will happen, not even if I manage to tell the truth. Stories without endings can do nothing but go on forever, and to be caught in one means that you must die before your part in it is played out. My only hope is that there is an end to what I am about to say, that somewhere I will find a break in the darkness. This hope is what I define as courage. But whether there is reason to hope is another question entirely. It was about 3 weeks after the plays had opened. I spent the night at Sophie's apartment as usual, and in the morning I went uptown to my place to do some work. I remember that I was supposed to be finishing a piece on 4 or 5 books of poetry, one of those frustrating hodgepodge reviews, and I was having trouble concentrating. My mind kept wandering away from the books on my desk, and every 5 minutes or so I would pop up from my chair and pace about the room. A strange story had been reported to me by Stuart Green the day before, and it was hard for me to stop thinking about it. According to Stuart, people were beginning to say that there was no such person as Fanshawe. The rumor was that I had invented him to perpetrate a hoax and had actually written the books myself. My first response was to laugh, and I made some crack about how Shakespeare hadn't written any plays either. But now that I had given some thought to it, I didn't know whether to feel insulted or flattered by this talk. Did people not trust me to tell the truth? Why would I go to the trouble of creating an entire body of work and then not want to take credit for it? And yet, did people really think I was capable of writing a book as good as Neverland? I realized that once all of Fanshawe's manuscripts had been published, it would be perfectly possible for me to write another book or two under his name, to do the work myself and yet pass it off as his. I was not planning to do this, of course, but the mere thought of it opened up certain bizarre and intriguing notions to me. What it means when a writer puts his name on a book, why some writers choose to hide behind a pseudonym, whether or not a writer has a real life anyway. It struck me that writing under another name might be something I would enjoy, to invent a secret identity for myself. And I wondered why I found this idea so attractive. One thought kept leading me to another, and by the time the subject was exhausted, I discovered that I had squandered most of the morning. 11:30 rolled around, the hour of the mail, and I made my ritual excursion down the elevator to see if there was anything in my box. This was always a crucial moment of the day for me, and I found it impossible to approach it calmly. There was always the hope that good news would be sitting there, an unexpected check, an offer of work, a letter that would somehow change my life. And by now the habit of anticipation was so much a part of me that I could scarcely look at my mailbox without getting a rush. This was my hiding place, the one spot in the world that was purely my own. And yet it linked me to the rest of the world, and in its magic darkness, there was the power to make things happen. There was only one letter for me that day. It came in a plain white envelope with a New York postmark and had no return address. The handwriting was unfamiliar to me. My name and address were printed out in block letters, and I couldn't even begin to guess who it was from. I opened the envelope in the elevator, and it was then, standing there on my way to the 9th floor, that the world fell on top of me. "Don't be angry with me for writing to you," the letter began. "At the risk of causing you heart failure, I wanted to send you one last word, to thank you for what you have done. I knew that you were the person to ask, but things have turned out even better than I thought they would. You have gone beyond the possible, and I am in your debt. Sophie and the child will be taken care of, and because of that, I can live with a clear conscience. I'm not going to explain myself here. In spite of this letter, I want you to go on thinking of me as dead. Nothing is more important than that, and you must not tell anyone that you've heard from me. I am not going to be found, and to speak of it would only lead to more trouble than it's worth. Above all, say nothing to Sophie. Make her divorce me and then marry her as soon as you can. I trust you to do that, and I give you my blessings. The child needs a father, and you're the only one I can count on. I want you to understand that I haven't lost my mind. I made certain decisions that were necessary, and though people have suffered, leaving was the best and kindest thing I have ever done. 7 years from the day of my disappearance will be the day of my death. I have passed judgment on myself, and no appeals will be heard. I beg you not to look for me. I have no desire to be found, and it seems to me that I have the right to live the rest of my life as I see fit. Threats are repugnant to me, but I have no choice but to give you this warning. If by some miracle you manage to track me down, I will kill you. I'm pleased that so much interest has been taken in my writing. I never had the slightest inkling that anything like this could happen. But it all seems so far away from me now. Writing books belongs to another life, and to think about it now leaves me cold. I will never try to claim any of the money, and I gladly give it to you and Sophie. Writing was an illness that plagued me for a long time, but now I have recovered from it. Rest assured that I won't be in touch again. You are free of me now, and I wish you a long and happy life. How much better that everything should come to this. You are my friend, and my one hope is that you will always be who you are. With me, it's another story. Wish me luck. There was no signature at the bottom of the letter, and for the next hour or two, I tried to persuade myself that it was a prank. If Fanshawe had written it, why would he have neglected to sign his name? I clung to this as evidence of a trick, desperately looking for an excuse to deny what had happened. But this optimism did not last very long, and little by little I forced myself to face the facts. There could be any number of reasons for the name to be left out, and the more I thought about it, the more clearly I saw that this was precisely why the letter should be considered genuine. A prankster would make a special point of including the name, but the real person would not think twice about it. Only someone not out to deceive would have the self-assurance to make such an apparent mistake. And then there were the final sentences of the letter. Remain who you are. With me, it's another story. Did this mean that Fanshawe had become someone else? Unquestionably, he was living under another name, but how was he living, and where? The New York postmark was something of a clue, perhaps, but it just as easily could have been a blind, a bit of false information to throw me off his track. Fanshawe had been extremely careful. I read the letter over and over, trying to pull it apart, looking for an opening, a way to read between the lines, but nothing came of it. The attempt to get inside it. In the end, I gave up, put the letter in a drawer of my desk, and admitted that I was lost, that nothing would ever be the same for me again. What bothered me most, I think, was my own stupidity. Looking back on it now, I saw that all the facts had been given to me at the start, as early as my first meeting with Sophie. For years, Fanshawe publishes nothing. Then he tells his wife what to do if anything should happen to him, contact me, get his work published, and then he vanishes. It was also obvious. The man wanted to leave, and he left. He simply got up one day and walked out on his pregnant wife, and because she trusted him, because it was inconceivable to her that he would do such a thing, she had no choice but to think he was dead. Sophie had deluded herself. But given the situation, it was hard to see how she could have done otherwise. I had no such excuse. Not once, from the very beginning, had I thought things through for myself. I had jumped right in with her, had rejoiced in accepting her misreading of the facts, and then had stopped thinking altogether. People have been shot for smaller crimes than that. The days went by. All my instincts told me to confide in Sophie, to share the letter with her, and yet I couldn't bring myself to do it. I was too afraid, too uncertain as to how she would react. In my stronger moods, I argued to myself that keeping silent was the only way to protect her. What possible good would it do for her to know that Fanshawe had walked out on her? She would blame herself for what had happened, and I didn't want her to be hurt. Underneath this noble silence, however, there was a second silence of panic and fear. Fanshawe was alive, and if I let Sophie know it, what would this knowledge do to us? The thought that Sophie might want him back was too much for me, and I did not have the courage to risk finding out. This was perhaps my greatest failure of all. If I had believed enough in Sophie's love for me, I would have been willing to risk anything. But at the time, there seemed to be no other choice, and so I did what Fanshawe had asked me to do, not for him, but for myself. I locked up the secret inside me and learned to hold my tongue. A few more days went by, and then I proposed marriage to Sophie. We had talked about it before, but this time I took it out of the realm of talk, making it clear to her that I meant business. I realized that I was acting out of character, humorless, inflexible, but I couldn't help myself. The uncertainty of the situation was impossible to live with, and I felt that I had to resolve things right then and there. Sophie noticed this change in me, of course, but since she didn't know the reason for it, she interpreted it as an excess of passion, the behavior of a nervous, overly ardent male panting after the thing he wanted most, which was also true. "Yes," she said, "she would marry me." Did I ever really think she would turn me down? "And I want to adopt Ben, too," I said. "I want him to have my name. It's important that he grow up thinking of me as his father." Sophie answered that she wouldn't have it any other way. It was the only thing that made sense, for all three of us. "And I want it to happen soon," I went on. "As soon as possible. In New York, you couldn't get a divorce for a year, and that's too long. I couldn't stand waiting that long. But there are other places, Alabama, Nevada, Mexico, God knows where. We could go off on a vacation, and by the time we got back, you'd be free to marry me." Sophie said that she liked the way that sounded, free to marry me.
If it meant going somewhere for a while, she would go, she said. She would go anywhere I wanted. After all, I said, he's been gone for more than a year now, almost a year and a half. It takes 7 years before a dead person can be declared officially dead. Things happen. Life moves on. Just think, we've known each other for almost a year.
To be precise, Sophie answered, you walked through that door for the first time on November 25th, 1976. In 8 more days, it will be exactly a year.
You remember?
Of course I remember. It was the most important day of my life.
We took a plane to Birmingham, Alabama, on November 27th, and were back in New York by the first week of December. On the 11th, we were married in City Hall, and afterward we went to a drunken dinner with about 20 of our friends. We spent that night at the Plaza, ordered a room service breakfast in the morning, and later that day flew to Minnesota with Ben. On the 18th, Sophie's parents gave us a wedding party at their house, and on the night of the 24th, we celebrated Norwegian Christmas. 2 days later, Sophie and I left the snow and went to Bermuda for a week and a half, then returned to Minnesota to fetch Ben. Our plan was to start looking for a new apartment as soon as we got back to New York. Somewhere over western Pennsylvania, about an hour into the flight, Ben peed through his diapers onto my lap. When I showed him the large dark spot on my pants, he laughed, clapped his hands together, and then, looking straight into my eyes, called me Da for the first time. Chapter 5. I dug into the present. Several months passed, and little by little it began to seem possible that I would survive. This was life in a foxhole, but Sophie and Ben were down there with me, and that was all I really wanted. As long as I remembered not to look up, the danger could not touch us. We moved to an apartment on Riverside Drive in February. Settling in carried us through to mid-spring, and I had little chance to dwell on Fanshawe. If the letter did not vanish from my thoughts altogether, it no longer posed the same threat. I was secure with Sophie now, and I felt that nothing could break us apart, not even Fanshawe, not even Fanshawe in the flesh. Or so it appeared to me then, whenever I happened to think of it. I understand now how badly I was deceiving myself, but I did not find that out until much later. By definition, a thought is something you are aware of. The fact that I did not once stop thinking about Fanshawe, that he was inside me day and night for all those months, was unknown to me at the time. And if you are not aware of having a thought, is it legitimate to say that you are thinking? I was haunted, perhaps. I was even possessed. But there were no signs of it. No clues to tell me what was happening. Daily life was full for me now. I hardly noticed that I was doing less work than I had in years. I had no job to go off to in the morning, and since Sophie and Ben were in the apartment with me, it was not very difficult to find excuses for avoiding my desk. My work schedule grew slack. Instead of beginning at 9 sharp every day, I sometimes didn't make it to my little room until 11 or 11:30. On top of that, Sophie's presence in the house was a constant temptation. Ben still took 1 or 2 naps a day, and in those quiet hours while he slept, it was hard for me not to think about her body. More often than not, we wound up making love. Sophie was just as hungry for it as I was, and as the weeks passed, the house was slowly eroticized, transformed into a domain of sexual possibilities. The netherworld rose up to the surface. Each room acquired its own memory. Each spot evoked a different moment, so that even in the calm of practical life, a particular patch of carpet, say, or the threshold of a particular door, was no longer strictly a thing, but a sensation, an echo of our erotic life. We had entered the paradox of desire. Our need for each other was inexhaustible, and the more it was fulfilled, the more it seemed to grow. Every now and then,
Sophie talked of looking for a job, but neither one of us felt any urgency about it. Our money was holding up well, and we even managed to put away quite a bit. Fanshawe's next book, Miracles, was in the works, and the advance from the contract had been heftier than the one from Neverland. According to the schedule that Stuart and I had charted out, the poems would come 6 months after Miracles, then Fanshawe's earliest novel, Blackouts, and last of all, the plays. Royalties from Neverland started coming in that March, and with checks suddenly arriving for one thing and another, all money problems evaporated. Like everything else that seemed to be happening, this was a new experience for me. For the past 8 or 9 years, my life had been a constant scrambling act, a frantic lunge from one paltry article to the next, and I had considered myself lucky whenever I could see ahead for more than a month or two. Care was embedded inside me. It was part of my blood, my corpuscles, and I hardly knew what it was to breathe without wondering if I could afford to pay the gas bill. Now, for the first time since I had gone out on my own, I realized that I didn't have to think about these things anymore. One morning, as I sat at my desk struggling over the final sentence of an article, groping for a phrase that was not there, it gradually dawned on me that I had been given a second chance. I could give this up and start again. I no longer had to write articles. I could move on to other things, begin to do the work I had always wanted to do. This was my chance to save myself, and I decided I'd be a fool not to take it. More weeks passed. I went into my room every morning, but nothing happened. Theoretically, I felt inspired, and whenever I was not working, my head was filled with ideas. But each time I sat down to put something on paper, my thoughts seemed to vanish. Words died the moment I lifted my pen. I started a number of projects, but nothing really took hold, and one by one I dropped them. I looked for excuses to explain why I couldn't get going. That was no problem, and before long I had come up with a whole litany. The adjustment to married life, the responsibilities of fatherhood, my new workroom, which seemed too cramped, the old habit of writing for a deadline, Sophie's body, the sudden windfall, everything. For several days, I even toyed with the idea of writing a detective novel, but then I got stuck with the plot and couldn't fit all the pieces together. I let my mind drift without purpose, hoping to persuade myself that idleness was proof of gathering strength, a sign that something was about to happen. For more than a month, the only thing I did was copy out passages from books. One of them, from Spinoza, I tacked onto my wall. And when he dreams, he does not want to write. He does not have the power to dream, he wants to write. And when he dreams he wants to write, he does not have the power to dream, he does not want to write. It's possible that I would have worked my way out of this slump. Whether it was a permanent condition or a passing phase is still unclear to me. My gut feeling is that for a time I was truly lost, floundering desperately inside myself, but I do not think this means my case was hopeless. Things were happening to me. I was living through great changes, and it was still too early to tell where they were going to lead. Then, unexpectedly, a solution presented itself. If that is too favorable a word, I will call it a compromise. Whatever it was, I put up very little resistance to it. It came at a vulnerable time for me, and my judgment was not all it should have been. This was my second crucial mistake, and it followed directly from the first. I was having lunch with Stuart one day near his office on the Upper East Side. Midway through the meal, he brought up the Fanshawe rumors again, and for the first time it occurred to me that he was actually beginning to have doubts. The subject was so fascinating to him that he couldn't stay away from it. His manner was arch, mockingly conspiratorial, but underneath the pose, I began to suspect that he was trying to trap me into a confession. I played along with him for a while and then, growing tired of the game, said that the one foolproof method for settling the question was to commission a biography. I made this remark in all innocence, as a logical point, not as a suggestion. But it seemed to strike Stuart as a splendid idea. He began to gush. Of course, the Fanshawe myth explained, perfectly obvious, of course, the true story at last. In a matter of minutes, he had the whole thing figured out. I would write the book. It would appear after all of Fanshawe's work had been published. And I could have as much time as I wanted, 2 years, 3 years, whatever. It would have to be an extraordinary book, Stuart added, a book equal to Fanshawe himself, but he had great confidence in me and he knew I could do the job. The proposal caught me off guard, and I treated it as a joke. But Stuart was serious. He wouldn't let me turn him down. Give it some thought, he said, and then tell me how you feel. I remained skeptical, but to be polite, I told him I would think about it. We agreed that I would give him a final answer by the end of the month. I discussed it with Sophie that night, but since I couldn't talk to her honestly, the conversation was not much help to me. It's up to you, she said. If you want to do it, I think you should go ahead. It doesn't bother you? No. At least I don't think so. It's already occurred to me that sooner or later there would be a book about him. If it has to happen, then better it should be by you than by someone else. I'd have to write about you and Fanshawe. It might be strange. A few pages will be enough. As long as you're the one who's writing them, I'm not really worried. Maybe, I said, not knowing how to continue. The toughest question, I suppose, is whether I want to get so involved in thinking about Fanshawe. Maybe it's time to let him fade away. It's your decision, but the fact is you could do this book better than anyone else, and it doesn't have to be a straight biography, you know. You could do something more interesting. Like what? I don't know. Something more personal, more gripping. The story of your friendship. It could be as much about you as about him. Maybe. At least it's an idea. The thing that puzzles me is how you can be so calm about it. Because I'm married to you and I love you, that's how. If you decide it's something you want to do, then I'm for it. I'm not blind, after all. I know you've been having trouble with your work, and I sometimes feel that I'm to blame for it. Maybe this is the kind of project you need to get started again. I had secretly been counting on Sophie to make the decision for me, assuming she would object, assuming we would talk about it once and that would be the end of it. But just the opposite had happened. I had backed myself into a corner, and my courage suddenly failed me. I let a couple of days go by, and then I called Stuart and told him I would do the book. This got me another free lunch, and after that I was on my own. There was never any question of telling the truth. Fanshawe had to be dead, or else the book would make no sense. Not only would I leave the letter out, but I would have to pretend that it had never been written. I make no bones about what I was planning to do. It was clear to me from the beginning, and I plunged into it with deceit in my heart. The book was a work of fiction. Even though it was based on facts, it could tell nothing but lies. I signed the contract, and afterwards I felt like a man who had signed away his soul. I wandered in my mind for several weeks looking for a way to begin. Every life is inexplicable, I kept telling myself. No matter how many facts are told, no matter how many details are given, the essential thing resists telling. To say that so-and-so was born here and went there, that he did this and did that he married this woman and had these children, that he lived, that he died, that he left behind these books or this battle or that bridge, none of that tells us very much. We all want to be told stories, and we listen to them in the same way we did when we were young. We imagine the real story inside the words, and to do this we substitute ourselves for the person in the story, pretending that we can understand him because we understand ourselves. This is a deception. We exist for ourselves, perhaps, and at times we even have a glimmer of who we are, but in the end we can never be sure. And as our lives go on, we become more and more opaque to ourselves, more and more aware of our own incoherence. No one can cross the boundary into another, for the simple reason that no one can gain access to himself. I thought back to something that had happened to me 8 years earlier, in June of 1970. Short of money, and with no immediate prospects for the summer, I took a temporary job as a census taker in Harlem. There were about 20 of us in the group, a commando corps of field workers hired to track down people who had not responded to the questionnaires sent out in the mail. We trained for several days in a dusty second-floor loft across from the Apollo Theater, and then, having mastered the intricacies of the forms and the basic rules of census-taker etiquette, dispersed into the neighborhood with our red, white, and blue shoulder bags to knock on doors, ask questions, and return with the facts. The first place I went to turned out to be the headquarters of a numbers operation. The door opened a sliver, a head poked out. Behind it, I could see a dozen men in a bare room writing on long picnic tables, and I was politely told that they weren't interested. That seemed to set the tone. In one apartment, I talked with a half-blind woman whose parents had been slaves. 20 minutes into the interview, it finally dawned on her that I wasn't black, and she started cackling with laughter. She had suspected it all along, she said, since my voice was funny, but she had trouble believing it. I was the first white person who had ever been inside her house. In another apartment, I came upon a household of 11 people, none of them older than 22. But for the most part, no one was there, and when they were, they wouldn't talk to me or let me in. Summer came, and the streets grew hot and humid, intolerable in the way that only New York can be. I would begin my rounds early, blundering stupidly from house to house, feeling more and more like a man from the moon. I finally spoke to the supervisor, a fast-talking black man who wore silk ascots and a sapphire ring, and explained my problem to him. It was then that I learned what was really expected of me. This man was paid a certain amount for each form a member of his crew turned in. The better our results, the more money would go into his pocket. "I'm not telling you what to do," he said, "but it seems to me that if you've given it an honest shot, then you shouldn't feel too bad." "Just give up?" I asked. "On the other hand," he continued philosophically, "the government wants completed forms. The more forms they get, the better they're going to feel. Now, I know you're an intelligent boy, and I know you don't get 5 when you put 2 and 2 together. Just because a door doesn't open when you knock on it doesn't mean that nobody's there. You've got to use your imagination, my friend. After all, we don't want the government to be unhappy, do we?" The job became considerably easier after that, but it was no longer the same job. My field work had turned into desk work, and instead of an investigator, I was now an inventor. Every day or two, I stopped by the office to pick up a new batch of forms and turn in the ones I had finished. But other than that, I didn't have to leave my apartment.
This is the end of disc number 8. Please insert disc number 9.